for me, I don't know if this is the process for every writer, but I think it's a big circle. And I think it took me 20 years to come back to what I instinctually knew at 16.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Sad Me of the Past, where we invite an established writer to revisit a piece they wrote in their tender years. That piece may fill them with affection, regret, nostalgia, embarrassment, relief, delight, anguish, all of the above, or something else entirely. Every infant must take those early, brave, awkward steps when learning to walk. We writers must make our own early, brave, awkward efforts as we set out to master our craft. So let's travel back to that ancient time when we were bursting with hubris or scared to death, drunk with language or paralyzed by it, determined to become a writer or terrified that we didn't have the stuff. I'll show them, we thought. But what did we show, really, and to whom? Hi, everybody. Welcome to Sad Me of the Past. I'm Stephen Lovely, director of the Iowa Young Writer Studio.
And I'm Lauren Haldeman, the editor at the Writing University.
And I'm Danny Colacci, director of the Magid Center for Writing here at the University of Iowa. And while it may be cold outside at the time of this recording, the snow piling up outside, the temperatures down into the absurdly single digits, our studio is filled with a unique warmth today. An exciting heat radiating across the room as we welcome our first guest of the new year, prose, film, and television writer extraordinaire, Josh Parkinson, to the show. Josh Parkinson received his MA in fiction from Johns Hopkins University, and over the last dozen years has written feature originals and rewrites for Warner Brothers, Sony, Universal, Paramount, and Media Rights Capital, as well as holding TV staff writing positions on the HBO comedy Eastbound and Down and the AMC horror series The Terror. He has sold both hour-long drama and half-hour comedy pilots to NBC, CBS, AMC, USA, Showtime, and most recently Peacock, and since 2022 has served as the inaugural faculty member for the Iowa Writers' Room, a bespoke, professionally-oriented program that prepares students to enter a career in television writing. From the moment I was fortunate to meet Josh, I was impressed by his ability to understand that writing isn't just a lie of the heart, or the cold remains of what begins with a passionate start. It's more than that to Josh, and his students here on campus and colleagues in the industry at large agree. His intelligence, care, humor, and creative ingenuity make him not only a writer to admire, but also a writer to learn from on and off the page or screen. We've talked a lot on this show with writers who made their way, got their start here at Iowa. We are thrilled today to shift the conversation to a writer who helped Iowa make its way, and get its start in a new mode of writing that simply wouldn't have been possible had he not brought his talents to campus. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming to Sad Me of the Past,
brother,
the winner of the 1998 George's Buffet's Intelligent Background Award, the one, the only, Josh Parkinson.
Woo! Welcome to the pod.
Oh, nice.
All right. It's good to have you on. Is it Josh or
or Yosh?
Or Yosh. That's
welcome, good. Josh.
Yeah, thank
Short.
You.
That's okay. So you're going to read something that you wrote when you were 16, right?
Yes.
Maybe we can go back to this period in your life when you were 16 and just kind of situate you, get some context. Where were you? You were in Texas, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
In the same little town.
What was the name of the town?
It's called Needville, as in need, like we need stuff, because there's just nothing here. Is literally where the guy was going to name it Needmore, but there was already a Needmore Texas, so he went with Needville.
Wow.
That's a true story.
How did you, we won't go back too far, but how did you come to be in Needville? Did your family go back there?
My family is all from the Valley of Texas on my mom's side, and pretty close to that on my dad's side.
Okay.
So my entire extended family lived in Victoria, Texas.
Oh, wow.
Is a much bigger town of like 50,000 people.
Okay.
Did your town have your own school?
Yeah. But it was a very small school. Like there were 92 people in my graduating class. Grew up in a little town and just a house of readers.
Yeah.
Like, big readers. And so there was always books around. And my dad was always, he did the thing that I recognized years later. I read this thing that John Steinbeck, his dad would keep all these books in this like break front.
Ooh.
And it was never locked, but it made it seem like you were doing something slightly
That's smart.
Roguish when you went in there to get a book.
Yeah.
And my dad did the same thing. He kept all of these like science fiction books in his closet. And it was like Isaac Asimov and stuff. It wasn't like stuff you couldn't read as a kid. But I remember having to climb up to get all those, or like going in there to get it. And he never said don't do it or anything, but it did feel a little bit like you were robbing dad's closet.
That's parenting.
Do you think he really did that intentionally?
No.
No,
no way. He is not a...
No bookshelves in this house.
Not a nuanced guy.
Were there bookshelves in the house with books on
them? No, not really. The books were just... Kind of scattered. Well, I guess so. In our rooms and stuff, we had books.
So is that what you were... did you read a lot of... Like, what were you reading when you were a kid, sort of...
I read a lot of, like you'll see from this right here, I was reading a lot of Stephen King at this point. But I don't know, I read a lot of Jack London and all the Tarzan books were huge in our house, and like the Martian Chronicles and all Bryce Burroughs stuff was like a huge thing.
I've never met anyone who read all those books. When they were young, because that's what I read.
Dude,
I've always felt really ashamed of myself.
And these two.
I read Edgar Rice Burroughs. Yeah. I read Dune. I read...
Yeah, I didn't get into Dune. My dad did.
Looking back now, I'm like, oh, why didn't...
Edgar Rice Burroughs is like king of the cliffhanger.
And the Conan books.
Oh, yeah. I never read those either.
Okay.
But the Tarzan books were like formative.
Wow. Huh.
Super formative for me.
At some point, you went from reading... And then to writing or to
the first story. Yeah, the first story I remember writing, I was probably like 9 or 10. And it was just stories my dad had told me that I think were kind of jokes.
Oh, it was like a book of jokes.
Yeah, well, but they were like, I fictionalized the jokes.
Oh, nice.
Oh, okay.
So they were like the one I remember, one of the first ones I ever put on paper was this guy rolls up at a camp and he looks like Conan. Right, he rides up on a horse in the Old West, and he's just super buff and muscular, and he's got like all of these weapons on him, and he gets down at this camp where this guy has like made some breakfast, and he grabs the bacon out of the hot grease and he just eats it, and he grabs a hot coffee and he just drinks it, and he's just like, you know, scalding himself, he doesn't care, and he gets back on his horse, and the guy at the camp is just terrified, and the guy on the horse says, I'd clear out if I were you. The guy after me is a mean son of a bitch.
Whoa.
And so I thought
it's
I would,
a dad joke, but
but evolved. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, let's narrate.
That was like one of the first things where I was like, I want to like spell that out in story form.
Wait, is this a genre? Like,
it's like O. Henry was like the king of those like switcheroo.
Right, but kind of endings. Has anyone taken, you know, your classic dumb, no offense, joke? And made them into short stories, or like, do you know what I mean? Like, this is brilliant.
Well, yeah, I don't know. You'll see this story has a little bit of that.
Okay.
Yeah. I was into like the O. Henry kind of like goofy thing at the time. I thought it was so cool.
Little twists.
Yeah.
So you're saying that you wrote the story when you were 9, and then like you kept writing.
I just kept writing stories, yeah.
Was anyone reading them, or were you sharing them with anyone, or was it something you were just kind of doing?
I would share them with my older brother was always a fan, or would always encourage me. I think he always wanted to be a writer, but never wanted to do it, the actual work. He calls himself an idea guy now. Because he does. He comes up with all these ideas, and he's like, I don't want to know how to do it. I just want somebody else to figure that out.
The world needs all
kinds.
All kinds.
Mm-hmm. In school, I remember in the 8th grade was one of the first stories I remember sharing with, like, the class. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember
that story was?
Yeah, just curiosity.
It was another switcheroo story. It was like a babysitter. It was a horror story. So it was like a babysitter's babysitting these two kids, and these flying creatures fly into the house.
Wow.
She has to battle them, and or she has to battle it. Like, it's a flying creature, and it she protects one of the kids. It kills the other kid, and she finally kills it in the room. And at the end of the story, she's like, you know, hugging the kid. It's going to be okay. And then they see like 6 more of these things fly into the house.
So wait, there was actual death in your stories?
Yeah.
Okay. Wait, yeah. I don't remember feeling like I was even allowed to include a real death.
I was reading Stephen King a lot, and like people just died.
Did you, when you were writing at first, were you thinking, I'm a writer, or were you just doing it because...
I was just doing it at first, but I think by the 8th grade and into like high school, I knew I was like, I might have to do something like journalism or something to get a job, but I wanted to do like write
That's awesome.
Fiction. That was my whole goal, was to be like a starving novelist.
Nice. So you knew what that was, and you knew it was a possibility.
I mean, I didn't have any, like, illusions, I guess, even early on about it's not something you build a career off of if you want to do it
right.
Well, and most of the friends I had in college were musicians, and they had the same kind of, like, you know, getting on Capitol Records isn't the goal. Like, the goal is to make this amazing music until Capitol and all these other places come to you. You know, and then it's fine. But if you go after it, you somehow undercut the, I don't know.
You sell out.
Yeah, it's like selling out.
It's wild because so many, well, Stephen King obviously is making his money writing, and so many of his characters are writers.
Yeah.
I wonder if you got like an idea from reading those books that some of them were like struggling writers or whatever.
It could be. I don't know that I ever thought about when that understanding developed.
Yeah.
I just must have I was a teenager, so everything was very romantic. And so it was like, yeah, I'm just going to, you know, fall in love a bunch. And I don't know. It was just like, I'm just going to be a sponge and soak everything up. And I realized from the stuff I was writing early on, I was just like something I realize way more now in hindsight, but it was like, oh, I'm not going to have anything to say for a while because I don't know anything. And that was like my mid-20s when I realized like, oh, you need to keep just writing.
Are you aware or do you remember sort of being, because again, you're going to read something from when you were 16, right?
Yeah.
So based on how you just explained this, you knew even at that age this is something that you wanted to sort of do.
Uh-huh.
Do you recall either support or pushback from family, friends? I mean, I'm thinking small town Texas, deciding like, hey, I want to be this artist. I'm just curious if you felt at that time, like, were you able to voice that to others? Was it just something you kept
in your mind? My parents were they come from, like, they're dirt poor, like, both of them. And so for them, it was like, as long as you went to college, they didn't care what you did. Like, you want to be an author? Go be an author. As long as you get your degree, you can do whatever you want. I don't care. But you got to get the college degree. Mm-hmm. That was the only requirement in that. So writing was always encouraged. And I had an uncle who wanted to be a poet or write poetry. And he told a friend of his about it, and they beat the shit out of him.
Oh, man.
And
but that will be really good for his poetry, though.
He never wrote again.
Oh, no.
He told me that. He told me that years later when I was going to college and I was going to become a writer. And he was just like, you should definitely do that. And then he told me that story.
Wow.
And I was like, whoa. I was like,
yeah.
Because this was like, he was like not a... I don't even know at the time what you equated poetry with, homosexuality and emotions,
right.
feelings.
Right.
That must have been good enough. But this was like a very tough, like, rural Texas guy. Like, he was not like a, you know, like an effete,
right.
Like someone from the ivory tower living out in the boonies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That story always stuck with me. It was weird. But I was very much encouraged. Everyone encouraged me. The sophomore English teacher...
And your peers,
who brought
too?
This contest to me and was just like, you should write something for this. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You
peers,
weren't beat up or picked
on? Oh, no. I was a quarterback of the football team. So,
wait, what?
I was just going to say.
No one messed with me.
I was just going to say, so.
Is that true?
So a couple of questions. Yeah. What else did you, what other stuff did you do? You played football?
I played football in high school, yeah.
Oh, you were the quarterback?
QB1, baby.
What was your number?
17.
What were your school colors?
Blue and white.
What was the mascot?
Blue Jay.
Wow.
Needville Blue Jays.
I bet those uniforms were super sweet.
They were pretty cool.
Yeah, I bet.
Well, cool. I'm amazed that you can sort of could hold those two things in, you know, in balance, like being an athlete, being a quarterback, writing, you know.
I don't know. It was a...
Did people you played football with know that you... quarterback. He's the smart one.
It was a little weird because, like, my high school class had more weirdos in it than normal.
Okay.
Nice.
And those weirdos just happened to also be like pretty talented athletes.
Okay.
For the small town. Like, yeah. I was never like, we had a guy on our team that went on to play at Baylor for 4 years, start for 4 years. He was a legitimate like superstar. And so we had tons of scouts that would come and just tell my head coach that I didn't have a college arm.
Aw.
So it was kind of like I was athletic in that small pond.
Right.
And so were these other guys, but they were also all weirdos. Like, we did one-act play, and, like, the theater stuff with the football and the track. And so like there was no kind of stigma around doing those things, that at least in the year that I was there.
That's, I feel like amazing. That story should be made into like a musical.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah.
So Josh, it's interesting to me, you mentioned reading Stephen King and other books growing up, obviously with your dad kind of having those books. Were there other things, if you think back to this time, 16, about to read this piece, you know, this also is the moment where I imagine we have things like MTV is huge, the way the sort of TV culture is, radio, music. Were there other things that you were sort of gravitating to at that time? Obviously, you mentioned sports, but were there other things that were sort of going on in your world that you were finding sort of new inspiration and excitement?
Girls.
heard of them.
Music was always around, but I was never musical. I just am not very good at instruments ever. So, but I mean, my dad is very into both country music and what at the time was classic rock. But like all the 60s and 70s music was around. So I was into all that, but I didn't like, and nobody that I was with really was playing instrument or like in bands. Like I know a lot of people when I got to college, it was like, oh yeah, I was in a band with that guy and that guy. And everybody was like musically oriented. And out there, it's like where I grew up, it wasn't, it just wasn't a thing.
If you're the quarterback, you don't really need to learn acoustic guitar because the quarterbackness gets you the girl.
The quarterback, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like the guitar's backup.
You don't have to do any writing or anything.
But I always loved that idea, especially like being able to play the piano. Was always like something
like Billy Joel, like your
Billy
favorite
fucking
artist.
Joel. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if you hadn't spent all that time throwing the football,
I know, and practicing and worried about my prima donna fingers.
Non-collegiate.
So speaking
arm.
Of your prima donna fingers, so where did you used to do your writing? Do you remember? Like, were you the kind of kid who wrote in your room?
Yeah.
Did you write?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
what was your room? Did you write
at
your desk?
We didn't have desks.
Did you have any rituals?
Like, no, that. Like desks was like a city thing.
No, in your room.
Desks were a city thing.
We had two beds and a chest of drawers in my room. Okay. I didn't have a desk, and I shared a room with my brother.
Where'd you do your homework?
In the living room or the kitchen table?
Okay.
Yeah, or in bed. You know, when I was a teenager, I did a lot of my homework in my closet. We had two closets in our room. Me and my brother, we felt rich because we each had our own closet. They were very small, but yeah, I had a little. Like corner in there, and I would just sit in there and write. But that was when I was really young. When I got older, it would, same as my homework, like kitchen table or in bed or something.
Okay.
Like that. Yeah. It wasn't, I didn't go anywhere to write like I started to, like you do now or in college or whatever.
Right,
like
right.
But this, what you're going to read, is that, was this written at home or was this like an assignment?
I don't know. It was so, this was a contest that it was either the Houston Chronicle or the Houston Post, and the Houston Post is gone. It doesn't exist anymore.
Wow. So big city paper.
Yeah, it was a big city paper.
I mean, they had desks.
Wow. Yeah, they did.
There were people with desks. I don't remember exactly which paper this is. I'm trying to see if it's on the thing. Yeah, it was one of those. The Chronicle's still around. The Post was not. But they had the short story contest, and my sophomore teacher I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
Said, you should enter this. Do you have any stories? And I was like, I'll write a story. And I got third place, and it was the I don't know why I remember this. It was a $50 gift certificate to a bookstore that I won.
Nice.
And I went and bought.
That's huge.
Robert Louis Stevenson's Kidnapped.
Okay.
And William Defoe's.
Robinson Crusoe.
Robinson Crusoe.
Yeah, yeah.
Jeez,
yeah.
Man. Could not remember.
I can edit
choice.
It. Try it again. Let's do it, and I'll
choices,
just edit it.
Though.
Well, they were.
$50 was a lot of books.
It was.
Back then.
It was. Well,
of course you remember it.
I only bought two books because they were like these really cool hardbacks.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And we never. All I ever had was paperbacks, unless they were from the library. So I was like, I'm getting these hard.
But you had good taste, though. I mean, the funny thing is, those two books are sort of really popular, sort of among, I feel like, young people, young boys especially, but also just like beautifully written.
Oh yeah.
Novels.
Like these had art in them that were.
Yeah.
They were. It was amazing. I still have them.
Yeah.
They're really cool books.
Well, maybe we've reached the time, Josh, when
we read some.
What is the format here? Do you read the whole thing?
Well,
how long is it?
It's not super long, but it's, I mean, it's like.
Is it a 2-minute read?
No.
Three?
Probably like a 5-minute read.
Why don't you just, do you want to just read excerpts? You could just read until you feel like you've read enough.
Like, we'll read and then I'll skip to the end.
Sure.
If you'd like, my initial idea for the podcast is that we workshop it.
Some notes?
Yeah.
He already got it.
Do notes for me or for 16-year-old me?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Or you could defend yourself.
I might do that. I might do some
Which one can we more easily hurt?
Probably 16-year-old.
I think 16-year-old can take a hit.
Let's do him.
Yeah, he
got sacked. Good. He was a quarterback.
It is interesting. I didn't know Josh at 16. I know him now, and I know the ways in which he's delicate.
Oh.
But also the ways in which he's...
He's delicate.
He's delicate.
Let's go. Let's do it.
Yeah.
All right. The Old Man and the Fly by me. This is on an old newspaper thing, so forgive me if I have to adjust. The old man blew into his harmonica. The sweet sound filled the kitchen, stilling everything. Spiders stopped their weaving. Roaches stopped their scurrying, and mice stopped their nibbling. Everything seemed mesmerized. The kitchen and its life all revolved around the harmonious blur of music that issued from the small piece of metal. Then the old man stopped, winded, and everything went back to normal. It was almost noon, and it was fire hot. The cruel sun baked the old wooden house that had sat in its place for nearly 60 years. There was no air conditioner, and buckets of sweat poured off the old man. He put the harmonica to his lips and blew. He slipped through the tunes with the ease of years of practice. Sorry, it's a lot of prepositional phrases. When the saints go marching in, Tom Dooley on top of Old Smokey, and on, no one listened to him, no one cared, partly because he was cranky and mean, but mostly because the old man was totally insane.
Whoa!
Twist. He's a crazy person.
I feel like trapped all of a sudden in this story with this man.
I was really into crazy, like insane people who were just insane. Like
no reason.
No reason, no traumatic backgrounds, just like absolutely.
That's what else like, is there to say?
Insane. Yeah. Insane. That was a trope in early Josh Parkinson. He wasn't married.
Well,
his wife had been killed in a tragic car accident nearly 15 years ago. Her head had been totally severed from her body. Her blood had literally flooded the car. He remembered so vividly because he had been trapped in the car for nearly an entire day, alone with his wife's head grinning stupidly at him.
Okay, so I think I know.
I guess we're stopping.
I think I know. I might know why this guy's insane.
Yeah. I think I know too.
You mention he's insane, and then you give a little backstory.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm not the writer, but
so you don't.
I don't think the guy was insane before that event. Maybe.
You don't think that you would your sanity would survive such a.
I think he might have been susceptible, but then there was a major
put him over the edge.
Yeah.
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 I agree.
Well, and it's interesting to me that you sort of lead with he was insane. He wasn't married.
Well, then I thought that the causality ends
anymore.
Up being
but yeah. that, but it's not anymore. He just says he wasn't married. His wife was decapitated. So it's not. It's just interesting. Cause it's not like he's a widower. It's he just isn't married. And just another thing you should know is that he was in the car with a pool of blood.
By the way,
and it was like grinning at him.
It feels like rereading it that there is like this like you want to step out your information slowly. To like I don't know where I would have got that from, but it was just like yeah, you start with he wasn't married, and then you're like because she was dead.
I know. You can tell you relish those little shockers.
I guess.
Like, you know what's funny though is like at that very beginning, I just heard so much Steinbeck. Were you reading Steinbeck?
Oh yeah.
Oh my god! I was just like, this was Steinbeck, and then
Grapes of Wrath time. So,
and I'd never read Grapes of Wrath until recently. It's the only Steinbeck I've read, and I just was like, wow, that's just so Steinbeckian, or whatever. And I loved it. It was amazing. And then I was like, oh, and here's Stephen King.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know.
It's like, all right. So, interesting. This is pretty. And now let's get into it.
Well, we should go a little further.
Was it like a, what's that movie, Inheritance type decapitating? Like, how did she lose her head in the car?
Well, let's keep reading.
There was more information. It was a car wreck.
Seatbelt.
She, yeah, seatbelt killed her. I don't know. Thanks for that note.
Maybe we'll.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. We'll talk about that.
16-year-old me would be like, I need to clarify.
Right.
Did it happen?
Okay. He had been wearing his seatbelt, and it hung upside down, wedged between the smashed-in door and the dash. His wife was wearing no seatbelt and suffered the consequences.
There's the lesson.
Her head had a death grin that was branded on the mind of the old man. He had dreams where he dangled there, blood rushing to his head, and his wife's head would speak to him, telling him he was next, that she was coming for him. Of course, the whole ordeal had driven all sanity from his mind. About a year after the accident, the voices arrived. Speaking low, almost inaudibly, they had begun to talk to the old man. They listened too, but mostly they just talked. Suddenly, the old man stood up, his head swiveling. What's the matter, old man? A voice asked. Here's where I have to go to my other copy.
Continued on page 9, D17.
Well, no, my dad did this funny thing where he sent me two copies. Okay, here we go. What's the matter, old man? A voice asked. Something, he began stuttering. Something buzzing. I don't hear it, soothed yet another voice. Shh, it's him, the old man said solemnly. A memory had hit him. Hit him with the force of a moving train.
Oh, there's the 16-year-old.
Yeah, I didn't really stretch for that one.
Love it.
Yeah. He was dangling. His wife's head grinned at him stupidly. A single fly buzzed around the head. It alighted on her nose and crawled up to her glazed eyes. Get off, he screamed, but it did not. It kept crawling, doing its fly business.
Messed up.
Now it was back. He knew it was the same fly. That the one that had crawled into her mouth and then her ears. It was that pesky little black fly that had made the whole accident seem natural somehow. It had almost saved his sanity. Almost. A fly, a link to reality, a natural pest whose job it was to annoy people, and it was here with him now. It soared through the air, crossing the kitchen, returning to the other side at impossible speeds. It buzzed around some partially eaten cake. Why does he have cake? Sorry.
He's insane.
He's insane. He baked himself a cake.
Also trying to find joy.
Where was I?
Cake.
It came toward the table where the man sat. It came with the speed only a fly can accomplish.
The speed of a train.
And it landed in front of the old man. He stared at it and suddenly realized he was holding his breath. He let it out slowly, not wanting to scare the fly. Then he clenched his fist and brought it off the table slowly. The fly seemed to stare at him, waiting. The old man cocked his wrist. He felt blood rushing through his body. He flung his fist forward with a sudden jerk and brought it down on the table. He picked up his hand and looked at it. No fly. The fly crossed the kitchen again, circling. It made a few rounds, passed the cake once more, and then headed for the table again, except this time it didn't land on the table. It glided over the vast expanse of the oak and then landed right on the old man's nose. Dun, dun, dun.
So is this man versus nature or versus himself?
Oh, versus nature.
Oh, okay.
And himself.
Yeah.
He is crazy.
At the moment, though, versus nature.
Yeah. This line is great. Tension hung thick in the air.
Yes.
So thick,
nice.
It seemed tangible. Nice. The old man hesitated a second and then brought his fist up quickly and struck his nose. A bolt of pain shot up into his head as he made contact. He yelped like a kicked dog. And tears came to his eyes. He looked through hazy vision and located the fly as it came to rest on one of the kitchen counters. You little. He swung a flat palm with amazing force down on the counter, but missed. The fly flew through the air gracefully. The old man dragged the back of his hand across his streaming eyes and cursed the fly. He chased it around the kitchen drunkenly, opening and closing his hands, trying to grab it. The fly always eluded him, though. Banking left and right, dodging at the last minute, escaping death. Finally, the old man collapsed in his chair, panting like a dog. His lungs burned. Sweat stung his eyes. He looked around the living room. His living room was small and sparsely furnished. In one corner, however, there was a small rack holding magazines and old newspapers. A smile came to his face. He laughed out loud. Now I got you, you lousy fly, he said.
Surprised by his own genius.
And also, it's his magazines.
Yeah.
Because I gave blood today.
Are you getting shivers? Because I am.
From this?
No.
Lawrence is from all the Red Bull.
Yeah, oh, yeah. A little too much Red Bull today.
In your turmeric shot.
Wait, I want to see what happens.
Okay.
Guys. Come on.
All right, so he's like, let me, I want to repeat this line of dialogue because I'm very proud of it. Now I got you, you lousy fly.
Yeah.
Whew. As soon as he caught his breath, he pulled himself out of his chair, stumbled over to the magazine rack. He fingered through it and finally brought out a thick National Geographic magazine.
Nice choice.
With a picture of an elephant on the front. The littlest
nature.
Animal.
It's nature versus nature.
It's nature versus nature. The littlest animal in the world killed by the biggest animal in the world, the old man said and laughed.
Just in case you missed it.
Yeah. I like the explanation attention. Of the metaphor. It's helpful.
That's cringe.
Oh, I love
insane.
It.
Insane. He talks to himself.
I love it.
It's okay if you're insane.
It was the elephant issue.
He stumbled into the kitchen. There it was, the source of all his enmity. The fly was crawling on the table, only it wasn't crawling on the table. It was crawling on his harmonica. He felt a hot rage start to burn in his stomach. It had no right. It had to die now. Had to. The old man advanced on the fly like a brooding storm. Angry clouds raced through his mind like rats. He felt a calmness come over him. That weird calmness that sometimes occurs right before the crashing of a thunderstorm. You could just see, like, when you're 16, everything is just derivative. You're just fucking ripping people off right and left.
Oh, yeah,
like,
of course.
This is, like, all, like,
of course.
Yeah.
You don't know yet that you're, you know.
that you can create these things. All right, so he coiled the magazine into a tight cylinder. His hand twitched.
Nice, that's nice.
With readiness, yeah.
Tight cylinder.
Fly. Crawled back and forth along the silver surface of the harmonica innocently. Here I come, you little pest, the old man whispered. He brought back his wrist slowly as he reached the table, his face clouded over with sheer concentration. Sweat rolled down his cheeks, dripping onto the floor. He tensed and then crashed the rolled-up magazine down on his harmonica. He looked at the magazine quickly. No fly. He screamed with frustration. Where are you? He screamed into the empty kitchen. He saw it sitting on the cake again, and he slapped the magazine at it. Chocolate filling hit the wall with a plop, and crumbs spewed all over the counter and floor.
Love a good plop.
Details. You want to get that sound in your fiction.
Right.
You know, like all five senses. Even hearing is the sight sense.
Even the sight of your ears, hearing.
Nothing like that sound of cake plopping against the wall.
The sight of the sound.
Plop.
It's been a lot of cake.
That would have been a big piece he smacked out with the magazine.
Where's the fly now?
Oh, man.
Is the harmonica okay? Did it get just crushed?
You know, I had that same thought, Steve.
I thought he was going to crush the harmonica.
And destroy everything he loves.
16-year-old me to, like, the harmonica flies across the room and, like,
into the cake.
Yeah, but that's okay.
Now he's really mad, and you just keep escalating into the cake. That's where you get the plop. The fly landed on the refrigerator. The old man swung the magazine again. Magnets flew to the floor. A ceramic magnet his wife had made centuries ago crashed to the floor.
There we go.
Splintering into a million billion pieces.
Did she make it for his birthday?
Well, you sort of did it.
Is
you
that
were sort
birthday
of
cake?
The harmonica, you know, would have been premature in a way because you were
building
you
to this.
This.
That's
yeah,
true.
Yeah. This
That's
is
true.
Yeah.
But she made it centuries ago?
Don't know.
Figuratively speaking.
No, okay. She made it as a child.
I get Danny's point, though, is like, why go figurative all of a sudden when everything else has been so literal?
Yeah.
Oh, wait.
No. I mean, eons, maybe. Then we all know, okay, it's not actual eons.
Right.
She's getting the whole.
But like, at this point, everything's so literal, you're like, is she a vampire?
Are they both reincarnated?
Yeah.
Reincarnated. Is the fly her?
Well, I'm beginning
to
wonder.
That's a good question.
Yeah, I'm beginning to wonder. Yeah.
And it's a very prescient question.
Thanks.
The old man tried again and again with no success. The fly had the luck of the devil himself. And maybe, after all, it was the devil. Mm. Maybe it was his wife.
Wow. Whoa, you guys, I did it.
Yeah.
You win the workshop.
Yes, yeah. I won it.
The wife in the dream who had promised to come for him.
Oh.
He threw the magazine at the wall, finally, and leaned against a counter. This was tougher than he thought.
What the hell?
Now he has to love the fly.
So, yeah.
Right. Take the fly on a drive.
This was tougher than he thought. that little thing moved as quick as light. What he needed was a plan. What you need is a bigger weapon, a voice blurted out. The old man jumped at the foreign voice. He hadn't noticed, but the voices had been relatively quiet through the whole ordeal. But maybe the voice was right. Maybe he needed a bigger weapon, something he could maneuver easily, something that would crush that little menace into oblivion. My bat, he said.
Surprising.
He's a bat?
Yeah.
What were you expecting? Like a bazooka?
I thought he was going to come back to the harmonica somehow and, like, throw the harmonica at it.
Interesting, yeah.
Continue.
Yeah. This should be a video game because...
Yeah.
Because I'm picturing, I watch a lot of people play video games online, but it's often like a barren inside of a house, and then all of a sudden there's a rack of magazines, and that
becomes a tool.
Blinks, and you're supposed to grab it, and then, like, I didn't see anything in the house, and suddenly there was like a magnet, cake, a bat.
Yeah, there was no description at the beginning of this house. It really, really starts with the sound of this harmonica.
Yeah, I mean, you're only allowing the essential stuff.
Right.
Server can process.
But also I feel like my 16-year-old self was just like, okay, so what happens when he goes after the fly now? Oh, let's put some magnets on the refrigerator. Right. Like, hurry, oh, yeah, and one of them crashes and his wife made it.
But I like the specificity of it. You know, it does make the world lived in. I also like that 16-year-old you was, you know, first I'm going to try to smack the fly with my hand. Then I'm going to punch myself in the face when the fly lands on my nose. Then I'm going to look for a bigger weapon, which at first is a magazine.
Yeah, you're escalating.
Yeah, and now what's next? Oh, the bat.
Yeah, and we're just getting started.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah. I mean,
it's like a there's first more escalations. Player.
There's an arsenal out back. There, yeah.
It gets it gets wiki, John Wiki in here.
Is this a parable? Are we going to learn a lesson?
A moral?
Ugh.
Not 16. 16. Okay. You're amoral then, right?
Yeah.
He strolled into his bedroom and threw open his closet door. He rummaged around through boxes and clothes and old shoes. He finally let out a little sigh of relief and brought out a 32-inch Louisville Slugger. His old hands fit snugly around it, and he felt powerful. Oh.
Snug around the slug.
Right, y'all, wait for this. Home run time, he said.
Oh, yes.
What the hell? I have not read this in years, guys.
It's pretty entertaining.
Pat on the back.
The fly buzzed around the kitchen ceaselessly.
Poor fly.
Never really landing, just buzzing. It dipped toward the ground and then glided back up to the ceiling. The old man watched this distantly. He was waiting for it to land. It swerved out of the kitchen and alighted on the coffee table in the living room.
That's a nice word.
It's alighted?
Yeah.
This is like a dude's version of Emily Dickinson's I Heard a Fly While I Died, right?
I love the fly. I love listening to the description of the fly moving. I feel like it's wonderful.
She just passively hears the fly, but...
Yeah. I feel like some of the best description is the fly flying.
Flying.
Which is, I'm totally around, seeing
yeah.
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It seemed to stare at him. He grimaced with pain as he brought the bat over his head. He strolled calmly towards the little table. He waited only a second before he brought the bat down. It was swung in a forceful arc, crashing the table in half.
I knew it. I knew
little splinters. Flew through the air.
Just trashing your house, dude.
Yeah.
And trashing your house.
And this is interesting. I don't understand how this happens. Little splinters flew through the air, pelting the sparse furniture. I've never seen that happen with a broken piece of furniture.
Did they get in the cake?
It's like a porcupine shooting its quills.
Well, it's fiction.
They get in the cake? The old man brought the bat up again and swung it, bringing it crashing down on his transistor radio.
Oh, yeah, like, what else can we put in the room?
Bury the lead, Parkinson.
What else can we put in the room?
The guy's got a transistor radio.
How chill is that?
Well, he broke it. He swung it again at the fly. What else does he have? Which was on the wall and crushed the wall inward, leaving a sizable hole. Again and again, the bat crashed. The living room was now a wreck. Mm. The fly went into the kitchen, and the old man commenced to destroy anything the fly chose to land on. He once again tired out and slumped in his chair. He fell asleep. Is this too long? Are we going too long?
No, keep going.
Okay. Go.
There's not much more left. He fell asleep. When he awoke, it was still daylight. He hadn't slept but an hour. He felt refreshed, though. "This is it, Fly. The final showdown," he said.
"Oh, no, no, just give up."
why the next?
I am, like, cringing towards the end of this thing, because you guys are going to fucking kill me.
I'm feeling for the guy now.
It is the worst ending I've ever written. I mean, not the ending, but you'll understand when you hear it. You'll probably predict what's coming. So he got up and kicked the bat he had used to wreck his house. He no longer wanted that. He was into bigger things now. Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed he do. He was going.
Whoa, wait a minute. Wait, we have to go back.
I think this is Stephen King. Like, I feel like characters, and he does that in his.
He's a little flip. Writers. He can be a little flip.
He'll put it like his bad guys will say stuff like that. They'll say things like, "Oh, that's right. Like, yes, indeed he do. I was going to get him."
Right.
I feel like I got that from Stephen King.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why we're going to forgive you for it. Got it from Steven.
Oh, boy. Yes, indeed he do. He was going for the big time. No bat for old man Fly Killer. No siree, Bob. This old man was going to take out that fly once and for all. He once again went into his bedroom. This time he passed the closet and went straight to his bed. He leaned over, wincing at the pain in his back, and brought out a single-shot 20-gauge shotgun.
Oh, boy.
I knew it was
smile.
Coming.
It was Texas.
I knew it was there under the bed.
A smile crossed his lips. "Now we see who's boss," he said. I fucking love this guy's dialogue. It's like the best
he's ever written. He's always happiest when he's picking up a new weapon.
I mean, and also just I'm going to say what the author just said out loud. You wait for it. It's coming. He fumbled through some drawers and found four shells. That ought to do it, he thought. He got back in the living room and popped open the shotgun. He slid the shell into the hole and clicked the gun shut again. That's how you load a gun. He then surveyed the room and located the fly on his chair. He aimed the gun and blew his chair to hell. The gun leapt in his hands like a live thing, stuffing from the chair littered the floor like bits of flesh.
Yes.
He loaded the gun and followed the fly back into the kitchen. It landed on the refrigerator door, and a second later, the refrigerator door was gone. In its place was a mass of mustard, ketchup, mayonnaise, milk, eggs, various other items.
Yeah, too tiring to list them all.
In the frigid air.
Wow.
He shot once more, blowing his cabinets to kingdom come. He loaded his final bullet.
I'm glad he doesn't have any pets.
Yeah. I'm sure he couldn't even handle plants. He loaded his final bullet and cocked the gun. The fly buzzed noisily around the remains of the kitchen. It floated here and there nonchalantly and finally came to rest on the stove. The old man took aim carefully. He wasn't planning on missing this time, and he didn't miss. He hit the oven square on and at the exact time turned his house, his harmonica, and himself into a huge fireball that engulfed the house like a hungry monster.
Nice.
The end?
And the fly flies away.
No.
Fly's not dying.
I haven't got to the end that's going to ruin my reputation with you.
Okay.
The fireman.
That wasn't it?
The fireman showed up. Yeah. A new character.
We're switching to the point of view of the fireman.
The fireman arrived promptly, as they do. It's in the nature of a fire.
He said, "Oh, looks like another."
He had some home security.
Looks another pesky fly situation we got here.
If I had a nickel for every.
Hey, this is the guy.
I'm a fly.
In his car next to his.
Drives an old crazy guy nuts.
Yeah.
Not only did they arrive promptly, they put the fire out.
Oh.
The old man's house was made of wood.
Unnecessary.
And burned pretty good before they got to it.
Burned pretty good.
One of the firemen crossed the yard to the police chief's car and sat on the hood. "Find anything?" the chief asked. "Probably the oven, I figure. Old man was crazy. Doubt if he ever checked the pilots on his stove. If they went out and that gas built up any little spark, and boom, bye-bye crazy old man." The fireman waved his hand. You guys wait for it. It's coming. Waved his hand in front of his face and shook his head. Something buzzed near his ear.
Nice.
The chief watched bemused as the fireman brought his hand palm down on the hood of the car. "You think that old man may have been shooting at someone? Neighbors say they heard shots coming from his house. That old man, the fireman replied, wiping his bloody corpse of the fly he had just smashed on his hand. He couldn't hurt a fly.
Oh!
Oh, I hate you.
Y'all didn't see that
it's
coming.
It's true.
I hate you.
No, I mean...
No,
I have Lauren, to say,
Lauren's like, good one, okay. Like,
I mean, I was really happy the fly. Yes. I'm very happy the fly flew past the police chief nose because I was waiting for that. I was like, the fly escapes. See, this is the incredible fly.
It.
He escapes everything.
No.
This is really a celebration of like municipal workers, right? Because like the fireman came and he got the fly the first time.
I mean, it's the heroes.
Yeah, they are the heroes.
It's so fascinating to me that this was. I mean, first of all, I think I haven't read the other ones, but I think better than third place finish, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. But also,
the
it's
first
it's,
place I remember was about a horse.
Well, this sort of gets to the crux of my sort of thought process here, which is so I guess maybe because this is Texas, but a lot of the stuff in here feels like surprising to me that they would publish in a newspaper. Like it starts with, here's a crazy guy, his wife was decapitated. Mm-hmm. Then there's a lot of like sort of violence and a gun shows up.
That's a great point. Like, what do you think would happen nowadays if somebody sent this to a newspaper? They'd probably like
come to your house.
Yeah, you'd probably get investigated.
I don't know. I mean, obviously, I mean,
you could definitely put this on Reddit.
what I notice a lot is like, is first of all, this sort of like very detailed description of physical action and the effort to sort of track the man's consciousness in a deliberate sort of conscientious way, which, you know, I feel like his little interjections of sort of resolves and things he's going to do and his little exclamations are all just part of like keeping touch with his consciousness as he sort of goes through these physical actions. But the thing that really strikes me is just how much fun you're having as you're writing this. Like, you know, I feel like you're just having a great time.
I remember it being one that I wrote it very fast.
Yeah.
Like I didn't like edit this or go back and do stuff.
Yeah.
It was like,
yeah, we can tell.
Yeah.
You had your fun.
And also just you're kind of letting yourself, you know, sort of enjoy those little cliches when they come up. I mean, they're fun.
Like,
they're fun to write down.
It's haunting though. It is a haunting psychological horror that this man, I mean, he's self-destructing. It's shadow work.
Well,
you know what I mean? Like,
no, I think there's a lot of very sophisticated stuff happening sort of underneath all the sort of funny kind of slapsticky fly-killing stuff.
Right.
Like he's like destroying his house because he thinks his wife is a...
And killing himself.
And the fly keeps looking at him, you know, like...
I know.
Which is weird.
And, it is, like, I feel like, the two things I notice rereading this now is like a complete terror at writing dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like, and I feel like I remember that too, how getting, I feel like it wasn't until I read Suttree, that Cormac McCarthy book, that I understood what I wanted to do with dialogue.
And when was that? Was that later?
That was in college.
Okay.
But that's when I realized, I don't think I've ever written dialogue. I just say what I wrote.
Yeah.
But the cop and the fire chief have a nice little exchange there.
Yeah, but it's all like kind of plot, you know, like
I mean, it's probably
not
a little
like idiosyncratic.
It's a third place level.
Yeah.
But it's interesting also,
you
Josh.
Yeah, right. You hear the dialogue in the first place
dialogue.
One.
That was my, that was like, my.
It's like Mammoth. The first place is like Mammoth.
My nickname in high school was Room Temp.
Room Temp. It was tepid.
Was it really?
No. That's going to be the name of my comedy special.
That's
Room Temp.
Josh, you started this conversation a little while ago talking about telling a story that was basically like a joke that your dad had said. And it's interesting because I did not see that ending come with the sort of, wouldn't hurt
a
fly.
Joke.
And it felt almost like it was either, I have this great idea for an ending and you were writing toward it, or you wrapped it up in the same way that sort of this sort of joke style would be. But I found it interesting hearing you read it, how much you have one character that is driving this plot. Right. So like every action, no matter how bizarre it gets, right? Sure. He gets a bat, he gets his gun, because you start with him losing his wife. And even though the first thing we hear is like, he's insane.
Yeah.
Then we learn, of course he's insane. He watched his wife get decapitated and he hung upside down because he was seatbelted and she wasn't. I mean, all of it makes sense. And I can't help but think about, you know, I've had the luxury of reading some of your prose mm-hmm. and also seeing the work you've done for television and talking to you a lot about writing for film and TV. When you read this now and then you mm-hmm. think of the class you're teaching right now on writing a television pilot, do you sort of see how in some ways you're already, even at 16, without maybe knowing it, you're sort of doing something that you're trying to teach students now, which is like hit these beats and tell a story in a framework that with the character sort of gives moments of action, but also, yes, dialogue, however you think it like is strong or not, but it like keeps me listening, but you know, on the screen, it sort of keeps you watching. It presents the reader or the viewer with something that they can't really look away from. I mean, that's all, it's all action.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, the whole thing. Like, I think for me, I don't know if this is the process for every writer, but I think it's a big circle. And I think it took me 20 years to come back to what I instinctually knew at 16, mm-hmm. which is you got to give people chocolate. Like, you got to give them story. Like, people want story. And I spent the 20 years in the interim really fighting against story and just thinking about image and, you know, the mot juste and the character just being people and as real as possible. And I think I just forgot about the fun of a good story.
Yeah, yeah.
In that, and finding the balance of those two is where I think I'm at now. To like, yeah, I think to find your voice sometimes you have to do all of that as a prose writer or fiction writer. Like you have to go out and like find all the cool, fancy, purple,
Purple Rain.
Purple Rain word when you're like haughty, but it's not haughty. It's like pretentious.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You got to get really pretentious with who you think you are and who you want to be to find that thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, Danny, I think I could tell from this, like, story to me was everything at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And then I spent a lot of time fighting against that. And then I came back to it specifically in the movie business and TV business. Is story is just one of the pillars. I think it is in all storytelling, but at the time I was like, well, of course there's story in not in fiction, but in movies and TV. And it's such an important leg of the table in that industry that I discovered it again, I feel like it was. Mm-hmm. And also I'd written a couple of novels before written a screenplay. And when I discovered that, I was just like, I don't want to write novels.
I want to write
screenplays.
So yeah, that's my question for you is maybe just to fill that in a little more, can you just talk about how did you evolve from fiction writing? Because you went on, you got an MFA or an MA at Hopkins, where probably, you know, experimental fiction is maybe sort of hot. I don't know where it was at the time. How did your fiction evolve? And then when and why did you kind of make that transition to sort of into television?
It really is as simple as like story. I feel like once I wrote my first screenplay and then I wrote another one shortly after that because I thought I understood the format just from watching mm-hmm. movies.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, there are rules here. There's a strict kind of system. And then you can fuck around all you want inside of that system, mm-hmm, but there's mm-hmm. the system. And that was just, I don't know, that still speaks to me.
Yeah, yeah.
Way to do it. And so at the time, I was just kind of like, I'm going to focus on writing a couple of screenplays and see what I can do with it. And I had good fortune to have somebody that was in a position to get one of those screenplays and kind of launch my career from it. But I was just like, I'll probably come back to fiction. I don't know. Like, I didn't actually have this thought where I was like, I'm done with fiction.
Right.
Screw it. I'm going to just do this.
Did those novels that you wrote or stories that you were writing, were they sort of plotless and like sort of in?
It's funny.
Or were you trying to work in
them? Two of them are kind of, they're it's about these two brothers. It's like a novel from each of the brothers' perspective. But they... They weren't super plot driven. They mm-hmm. they do have plots, but they're not plot driven. But then the one that I wrote after I left Hopkins is very much plot, and that's the one that I adapted into a screen.
Oh, so there's literally like a translation.
Yeah, I was 3/4 through this novel, and I'd written the other screenplay with some buddies of mine, and didn't like writing with them, and mm-hmm. and was like, I'm gonna write my own thing. And I was like, this is the first novel I've ever written with this story in it.
Yeah.
That's probably a good, and I have the story worked out, so I'm going to write a screenplay based off of that. And
so
that's the script that kind of got me all of my business.
Yeah. So I know I'm monopolizing the conversation. Just to drill down a little more. So what was it about your experience of writing that novel that made you decide to write a screenplay instead? Like, it was just, did you not want to sort of
scenes? Like, I was writing scenes in that novel and I'd never written scenes before. I think all of my stuff was like people in the middle of doing a lot of what I wrote was already cinematic.
Okay.
You know, but it wasn't like, I don't know. There were just these scenes that when I was writing that novel, I was just like, that would be a cool scene to see in a movie.
Okay.
And it just kind of lent itself visually to adapting. But also, I really like it, and I still like it to this day when I'm adapting something. I prefer to adapt things because they've already got the basic architecture built.
Yeah.
And that is the hardest part. That's what takes the longest time, is to build the world and the architecture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's also like where you can kind of separate yourself in the industry, because not everybody can do that.
Yeah.
And I think fiction writers have a leg up in that sphere, because you are a world builder just by nature of the craft that you have honed. Whereas if you come out of college writing screenplays, you know, you haven't really worked those muscles of like building whole universes.
Well, that's why you had to.
Your head.
That's why you had to go all the way out away from the action,
and come
right?
Back. Yeah. I think about world that build? Sometimes. I think if I would have been as successful without, like, you know, for years just being like, I'm going to be a starving writer. I'm not going to do any of that.
Was it an exciting moment when you started to work on the screenplay, or was it scary, or did you feel like you were making a huge leap, or did you think, or did you feel like, hey, I'm finally finding something that I really,
I don't know.
Or did
I was
it just
pretty excited.
Okay. Yeah.
Like, I was like, when I got like halfway through it, I felt like, I was like, this is good.
Cool.
Like, I like this. Like I was having fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was having fun, and I still look for that when I'm writing. Like, if I stop having fun with something, I'm like, oh, this is going in the wrong direction, or I need to, because if it's not fun, I don't know.
I wanted to ask a quick question. So, I mean, a screenplay is basically like a structure built by dialogue, though. So how do you take a world that's been built in scenes that have been written, and then it just kind of blows my mind that you have to strip all that out, and you have to just make it dialogue.
People talking. Well, the world is also in the stage directions.
Okay. I mean,
because it's such a visual medium, when you're writing the scripts, you do have to kind of orient your reader just in the same way that you would have to orient your viewer. You have to think in that frame. So you do build your world out in the stage directions as well. But also with the, you know, what the people are talking about is usually your story, you know. So if they're talking about, you know, some soap opera emotional thing, that's one thing. If they're talking about how do we get out of this because all the werewolves just woke up, you've built a little bit of a world that now has werewolves because of the dialogue where they told you it had werewolves, you know. So it's like a little of both. But you do, stage directions are one of the key kind of skills.
If we were to make The Man and the Fly into a screenplay, it'd be mostly stage directions.
Yeah. Okay. Did you ever see that Robert Redford movie where his boat sinks and he's got to stay alive?
I did.
It was pretty recently, like maybe 6 years ago,
no
something
way.
Like that. But it's like, I read the script for that. It's like 20 pages.
Wow.
It's an hour and a half movie.
Okay, so.
And it's just like a, or like a David Green, that movie Prince Avalanche that he made some years ago, 55 pages. It's like an hour and 25 minute movie. But it's like a lot of it is atmosphere. And he, like, sometimes you have the luxury as a director where you know this is going to take 20 minutes of film.
Right.
On these two pages. I know what that's going to be. But yeah, like this, you're right. This would have very little dialogue.
But it'd be a hit.
Yeah. And, you know, if y'all remember Gina Welch, when Gina Welch was doing The Big Binge, she said that quote that, like, writing for TV or movies is like always you're trying to get back to silence.
Mm-hmm.
That's your goal, is to like let the actors act without you having to put words in their mouth.
Mm.
And so if your stage directions are good, then it's going to be a fun read, whether people are talking or not, you know?
So Josh, you write this third place story. You end up in...
third place dialogue.
And then you end up getting published in the newspaper. You're in Texas. Yeah. You go to UT Austin for
college. And I started as a journalism major. And then I just did one semester and then I was like, fuck that. I'm gonna be a writer. Mm-hmm. So I changed my major to English and just, I was like, I don't have anything to say, so I need to read for years. And so I just started reading.
And so you're reading, you end up at Hopkins.
I tried to go to grad school for English and didn't get in anywhere. And so I just worked shitty jobs and wrote a bunch and read a bunch. And then finally, after about 4 years of that, I was like, this sucks. I'm going to grad school. And I did get in for fiction at Hopkins.
At Hopkins. Yeah. And so you're in Hopkins. And then, you know, again, I have the luxury of just having talked to you about this, but you end up for a little while, you were in Georgia. Mm-hmm. You end up in LA. You've been in LA for a long time. And we're recording this here in Iowa City. And I mentioned in the introduction that you've been the sort of founding instructor for the Iowa Writers Room. And I'm just curious, coming from all of the, you know, Austin has a great literary and arts community, and being in your master's program and being even in places like Georgia and LA, what has it been like for you as a writer and artist to now be in Iowa City?
Mm. I think the short answer to that is I actually love it here. I wouldn't say, honestly, that that has everything to do with it being literary, but that is definitely a key component of it. I'd tell you this, like I had not finished a book in, I don't even, maybe I've read two books over the last.
You mean reading a book, not writing a book?
Reading a book. I had not finished reading a novel, like a fiction novel, in probably 5 years or 6 years. That was not part of my job. To like try to adapt or something.
Yeah.
I've read three since August being here. And I can't tell you why or what shifted. I like to think it's just in the atmosphere
it's
in this place.
It's pure pressure.
It's pure pressure.
Right, right.
But I mean, I don't know. I love being, and Athens has that same feel, but with music.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like this has it with, with writing, and it just, it's a huge part of what makes it so fun to be here and exciting. Like, I just feel excited to be here, you know?
Yeah.
And that's cool. That's like, I haven't felt that in a long time. Like, LA had worn off.
Yeah.
That feeling is like, was totally like drudgery. It wasn't exciting anymore to live there.
Well, we're so glad you're here. It's one of my main goals in life to get
great
genius people here and then keep them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have them stay.
I do think you should get an e-bike. I'm just gonna throw that out there. The town's real fun on one.
And he said all those nice things about Iowa City when it was, the high was like negative 15 a few days ago. So
yeah,
you must really like
it's cool that we handle it.
Yeah. So Josh, I don't know. We usually ask this question sort of at the end, and maybe we've asked it already. We actually ask a few questions, but if you could go back to that 16-year-old from your sort of current vantage and give him some advice or words of wisdom or say anything to him, what do you what would you say to him?
I would say to, I would honestly tell him to write more. I feel like there was a lot of time, and I feel like I did write, but there was a lot of time in there where I would talk myself out of writing because I was just like, you're not good. Like, this is the same. You just are repeating stuff you see. You know, I remember talking myself out, and I think that's the big thing that I would tell them is, like, trust your process, because it's going to seem weird and debilitating at times. But if something good comes out of the other end, and it always did, it always does, that you just got to trust that. That's what I would tell a 16-year-old.
I think that's great.
Trust the doubt.
I think that's great.
Do you think he'd be proud of you now? Do you think he'd be?
I was voted most likely to succeed in my 92 people. But I don't know. I think so. I think 16-year-old Josh's big goal was to leave Needville, Texas and never come back, and he did that.
Right on.
Yeah.
I mean, I've gone back, you know, here and there because I had family there, but now they're all gone.
You went back, you go back to see the statue of yourself.
Yeah. And you're throwing with your non-collegiate arm.
Yeah.
I mean, like, if
doesn't
you
have
brought
a college arm, but he's a pretty good little quarterback. That's what they say.
Little
the guy
quarterback?
From, no, yeah. The guy from Ohio State who was – like recruiting.
Well, Ohio State.
Yeah, he was heavily recruiting this guy I played with. And I remember my coach told me that. I don't know why that fucker would tell me that, but he did. He was just like
pretty good.
The Ohio State guy thought you were he said you're pretty good quarterback. I mean, he said pretty good little quarterback. Doesn't have a college arm, pretty good little quarterback.
Still, man, from the Ohio State coach. I think that counts
for
a lot.
Well, their scouting coach.
That counts for a lot. Like
Anyway.
Danny has a question. I'll let him ask it.
So Josh, one of the other things we like to always know is in whatever ways you can talk about it, what are you working on now?
Mm.
And is there a fly in it?
No flies. I am working on a two screenplays, one of which is about a brother who is possessed by a demon, and his younger brother, they're on this road trip going to these places trying to get the demon out of him.
Mm.
That's the basic story. It's a lot of emotional.
Is it like a feature length sort of?
It's a feature length script.
Okay. Cool.
Everyone is writing feature length scripts right now because TV is insane.
Interesting.
So that one, and then there's another one about this guy who he's in his 40s, and he goes and convinces this old couple to adopt him.
Wow.
Because they're rich.
Whoa.
It's a comedy.
Nice.
I just kind of started on that with it's set up with an actor and this other guy, and so I've just gotten into that and trying to figure out if I really want to do that, but I think I do because it's so ludicrous. And then me and Danielle, my lovely wife, Danielle Roderick, we're about to take out a TV show.
No way.
That is called California Gothic.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we're excited about
it. And take out means shop it around?
Try to get somebody to buy it.
So, cool. Like, it's done?
The pitch, we have a pitch
done,
and we have producers signed on, and so we have to get a plan together. This is the word that's killing me lately, but everything is targeted.
Oh.
We have to be targeted.
Is there a pilot?
No, not yet.
Oh, okay.
What we would do, we develop a pitch to go to these people and say, hey, pay me to write this pilot.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And there, you can also write a pilot and go to them and say, hey, I wrote this pilot. Pay me to write the rest of the show.
Right.
So there's different avenues to do, but this is the best way to do it because you get paid to write the pilot, mm-hmm. you know, instead of the other way around.
Is it better to already have like an actor on board or producers?
It used to be. It's not anymore in TV. In movies, it still is.
Okay.
Like having an actor who's excited about it, who will go into like rich people finance, not studios, but like that's who pays for movies now.
Mm.
Is you go to a rich, like your group of rich people, and you have these two actors with you. And a writer like me, they've never heard of. And then you say, here's the story. And they're like, okay, we'll pay you to write a script. But yeah, in TV, no. In TV, it's all about targeting now. So you can have, like, there's the story going around now is Nicole Kidman and Will Ferrell had this whole television show put together. And they had these very accomplished writers. And like they went to four places and everyone said no.
Wow.
Which used to be like 5 years ago, that would be a home run.
Mm-hmm.
That wouldn't even be, there would be a bidding war.
And they said no because it wasn't targeted, right?
It wasn't on their slate of things that they're targeting to try to get viewers to monetize their product, which they're struggling to do.
Mm.
They don't know how to get money out of streaming.
I'm glad that Nicole Kidman takes a loss once in a while, too. That's somehow comforting.
It just makes her more human.
She's in everything.
I know.
Josh, we are so grateful for your time.
I'm grateful.
Today.
Thank you so much.
I've got to read that story again. I haven't read it in a long time.
It was super.
It was a blast. Yeah,
thank you for inviting me, Danny.
Of course. And we're also just really grateful to have you as part of our Iowa City and University of Iowa family. The university is lucky. Our students are lucky.
I'm glad to be here.
And we can't wait to hear more of the things you're doing in the future.
Yeah, me neither. Thank you.
I thought that was a different
Leave
one.
Leave that one in.
Thanks, everybody. See you next
time. That's what I was trying to do.
That's what you're trying to hit. Yeah.
Support for this podcast comes from the University of Iowa, the Magid Center for Writing, the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, and the Graduate College. We'd like to thank the Center for Language and Culture Learning for use of their podcast studio. Sad Me of the Past is part of the Writing University Podcast Network at the University of Iowa. This network includes podcasts from creative writing programs and departments all across our campus. Visit writinguniversity.org/podcasts to see our full list of offerings, including Writing Matters, The 11th Hour, Origins, The Short Coat, and more.
Who is this? Do you like my shirt, by the way?
I noticed that as soon as...
It's The Legend of Zelda. It's a pajama shirt.
Yeah.
And this morning I went
so
to...
good.
I threw on my sweater and coat to go sweep the things, and
you
I came back in and forgot that I left this
that's
on.
That's Iowa's form. Do you think Lauren about what she was wearing?
I don't. I pick up the first t-shirt in the pile, and then I pick up pants that have been worn less than 4 days. Yeah.